mission. We run the crowd loud. This pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips and Nolan Higdon. Today's show, The Untold History of the United States, with special guest Professor Peter Kuznick. We'll discuss various anniversaries, including the 100th anniversary of the use of chemical weapons and WMDs, 70th anniversary of the ending of World War II, and the many myths that persist around the U.S. and USSR involvement there, as well as the 40th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. Please stay with us for our special show with a discussion on the importance of historical commemoration and the politics of memory. You are listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips and Nolan Higdon. On today's program, we take another look at the untold history of the United States. We're going to be joined by author and professor Peter Kuznick, who, along with Oliver Stone, did the book The Untold History of the United States and the DVD series. We're going to be talking about various historical anniversaries. We'll be talking about historical commemoration and the politics of memory. Right now, here is Peter to introduce Peter Kuznick.
Peter Kuznick is a professor of history and director of the award-winning Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, and currently serving his third term as a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians. He has written extensively about science, politics, nuclear history, and Cold War culture. Peter, thank you very much for joining us. What's remarkable to you now about this entire book? What are people most excited about?
The documentaries have been airing all over the world. The book is out in about 15 different languages now. The Russian translation came out recently and was a bestseller in Russia. So we're getting wonderful feedback all over the world. And the show, actually, I was told just recently by somebody, a leading media person in Russia, he said that the book is prominently featured in every bookstore in Moscow. And there have been a series of TV shows in Russia devoted to discussions of untold history with panels of experts just going through the entire series. And we're getting a similar kind of response in China. I got a very similar response in Japan, where it's doing very, very well. The UK, so around much of the world. So in a sense, we're gaining access to people in a way that is very, very rare for American historians, as you know. We're actually being able to influence the debate in much of the world now. Unfortunately, we don't get nearly as much play and attention by the U.S. media. Oliver's new movie on Snowden is certainly going to capture a lot of attention, but the U.S. media, for the most part, tries to freeze us out. But that's not the case in the rest of the world right now. So the things that people respond to, just the importance of understanding history in general. The lack of historical consciousness in this country is just astounding.
Well, Peter Kuznick, you certainly are saying that. I mean, not only do we do media censorship, but, you know, Nolan Higdon, who's here with me, as historians like you, there's a lot of unpacking that needs to be done, and just a lot of assumptions and myths and things, even that beyond that, even things people have never even considered. Let's take a waltz through some of the 20th century with you. You were recently in Europe, and you were at a conference, a century of weapons of mass destruction, and you were talking there about this would be the 100th anniversary of the use of chemical weapons and so forth. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, April 22nd, 1915, was the first successful use of chemical weapons in World War I. It was the German use against French troops at Ypres, Belgium. That was not actually the first use, though. The first use was by the Germans in Bomelao, Russia. But that was not successful, so the Ypres event is the one that's most noted. It was quite successful. The reports in the media were frightening in terms of the effect that it had on French troops. The British tried to retaliate soon thereafter and lose, but unfortunately the winds shifted and the poison gas blew back on them. So that was not very successful. It's really 2 years later, with the introduction of the mustard gas, that the poison gas becomes much more devastating. The country that suffered the most was the country that was least prepared to defend itself, and that was Russia. The Russian casualties were very, very high from the poison gas in World War I. The other countries didn't suffer nearly as badly from it. The interesting story for the United States is that the chemical warfare research that was conducted in the United States was conducted at American University, at my university. In fact, the Army Chemical Warfare Service took over 60 buildings at the university, brought most of the prominent chemists from all over the United States to American University, and that's where they did the scientific research for the project. It was having an effect on people in the neighborhood. There was lots of gases that escaped. They're still finding deposits of poison gas that were buried under the ground throughout the neighborhood. So this is still having effects, so the Army Corps of Engineers is always digging up areas in order to get rid of these wastes. But it was being manufactured and being tested, really, for the most part, in Aberdeen Proving Ground. And they had produced a tremendous amount of poison gas there. The head of the program there, General Walker, said that the United States didn't get to use it. He said, we had developed these one-ton canisters that could be dropped on a city and wipe out an entire city. He said, we felt as if we'd been cheated out of our prey because we didn't get a chance to use them. But we were ready to use them when the war ended. And we had a massive amount of poison gas that the United States had produced at that point.
So we were the original weapons of mass destruction supporters globally. Is that correct?
I would say that the Germans were ahead of us first. And the British and the French weren't doing so badly either.
But we're building one that would take out an entire city. That would
seems quite amazing
to me.
We're always more efficient. Yes, we certainly had perfected it and done it on a real industrial scale, as the Americans were capable of doing it. By the end of the war, we were outproducing everybody. And the interesting thing is, the chemists were leading the fight against the ban of chemical weapons after the war. Protocols, the Geneva Protocols against the use of chemical weapon, were being opposed by the American chemists. The very opposite response than we have after World War II to the use of nuclear weapons, where the physicists are leading the fight for the banning of nuclear weapons after World War II. The chemists were always the most conservative wing of the scientific community in the United States. And that was the case in this period also. They thought they had done their patriotic duty and would have been instrumental in winning the war had the war gone on a little bit longer. And they, too, felt as if they were cheated of their prey.
Peter, this is Nolan Higdon. As you know, here at Project Censored, we look at issues of censorship, particularly in media. But when it comes to these historical events, are these type of stories that you unearth in the untold history of the U.S., are these purposely censored? Is it done intentionally? Or can you explain of how this sort of process, these stories are not discussed? Are they discussed in academia only or not even in academia, but just hidden from the public? Explain how these stories are untold.
Well, actually, the narrative that Oliver and I produced is really the kind of teaching and the kind of education that has been going on at the best universities in the United States for some time. What happened in the 1960s and 1970s is a lot of that new left generation went into academia. And even though in the 1960s the history profession was still pretty conservative, and to even get the history profession to come out against the Vietnam War was a real struggle in the 1960s, by the 1970s and 1980s the center has shifted far to the left in terms of professional historians in the United States. So a lot of the kinds of things we're talking about, maybe not the specifics we're talking about, what we try to do with our books and documentaries is arm historians with the kind of information and data and the kinds of materials that they need in order to make these cases that much more persuasively, to challenge the view that the general public has. The problem is, it's very, very difficult to get this kind of material into the middle schools and the high schools. What we've found is that our book is widely adopted in colleges, some private high schools, but it's difficult to get our books into the public schools. But a lot of the teachers use documentary, and our documentaries have been getting into the public schools. In order to try to combat that, Oliver and I are producing a series of young readers' volumes of Untold History. We're putting out a four-volume set for Untold History for middle school kids. The first volume is out already. We've got three more coming. We've also got a graphic novel version of Untold History in the works. So we're trying to reach people on every different level. There's also been, in addition to the big book, the 800-page book, we've got the Concise Untold History, which is a shorter version, not an abbreviation, but it's a different book based on the documentary scripts. So I think the effort is really paying off right now. We're working with middle school teachers around the country, high school teachers around the country. We're doing webinars. We're doing special trainings. We've got special training sessions in New York this summer. So we're making some real headway. But it's the kind of thing that we need a real push nationally. California, we actually were looking at one point about getting the book and the documentaries adopted as part of the official California school system curriculum, but we were told that the initial investment on our part would be over $200,000 to even have the chance of getting it to all the people we needed to get it to. So that was a little bit beyond our means at that point. But we're getting good response from individual educators, but in certain places, the heads of the school boards and the curriculum committees are working very closely with us, as are some of the master teachers around the country right now.
We're using it in some of our classes, and it's very useful. It brings up a lot of great questions for people, and the fact that it's also the DVD series means it's more accessible to people who are intimidated by a 750-page book. But I know you had to keep some things out of the book, and of course, at Project Censored, we've had trouble keeping the book under 400 or 500 pages, so there's unfortunately a lot to discuss. You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Nolan Higdon. We're speaking with Professor Peter Cousins, American University, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Peter Kuznick, let's move over to World War II. This is an area, of course, that you've done a lot on, and I know you were recently in Europe, and you were also talking about some of the myths at the end of the war, these untold histories, so to speak, about the role of Russia, the Soviet Union, etc. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and about some of the myths at the end of the war?
Yes, I've been arguing that there are three fundamental things about World War II that Americans are taught in the schools that are completely false. The first is that the United States won the war in Europe. The second is that the atomic bombs ended the Pacific War. And the third is that the Cold War began during World War II because of Soviet aggression, Soviet territorial aggrandizement. All three of those myths are fundamentally false. Let me start with the first one, because I think that's in some ways the most timely and the most important. Americans believe that it was the United States that won the war in Europe. The American narrative on World War II is almost perverse. It begins on December 7th, 1941. That's maybe a debatable starting point, but let's start there. And then the United States is in a period of somewhat hiatus, and it's gearing up and mobilizing and getting ready to do the fighting. Then the United States enters the war in Northern Africa and in Italy, and we do a little bit of fighting. But the real start of the war from the American perspective is June 6, 1944, D-Day, with the invasion of Normandy. American troops do bravely overcome the heavily fortified Germans and storm the beaches in Normandy and push back the Germans, and then it's a march to Berlin. And then the United States reaches Berlin, the German regime falls, and the United States is the triumphant victors in the war. The reality, of course, is quite different. The war from the Russian standpoint, from the Soviet standpoint, begins much earlier. You can argue that it begins in the 1930s when the Soviets are pushing the West to join them in a collective defense against Hitler and the Germans, and the West has no interest in doing so. You can maybe trace it back to the Italians in Ethiopia, or you can trace it to the Spanish Civil War, and in which the United States maintained this dumb backward neutrality, and the Soviets were the only force really supporting the Spanish Republic against Hitler and Mussolini and Franco's forces in Spain. But in terms of the actual war itself, when the war and the fighting began with the Russians and the Germans and the Americans and the Brits, what people in the United States don't realize is that throughout most of the war, the United States and the British were confronting 10 German divisions combined, while the Soviets were confronting 200 or over 200. That was until June 6, 1944. The Soviets had been pressing the West to open up the second front. And in fact, Roosevelt wrote to Stalin and asked him to send Molotov and a trusted general to Washington in May of 1942. And at that meeting, they issued a public communique in which they said that we would open up the second front in Europe before the end of 1942. The Soviets were elated. They were thrilled. This is what they were counting on more than anything else, any of their other requests or demands. But the United States failed to do so, not because Roosevelt didn't want to, and certainly not because the American military didn't want to. They absolutely wanted to. It was because Churchill resisted doing that, and that's a lot of issues involved with why that was the case. But the American military leaders were furious. When the United States announced that it was going to instead go along with Operation Torch in northern Africa, Marshall and Eisenhower were furious. Marshall called it periphery pecking. Eisenhower, who led the assault, said that the day the United States invades northern Africa is going to be the blackest day in American history. Marshall was so angry that he actually proposed shifting the focus, having the United States fight the war in the Pacific first, and then after they took care of Japan, then worry about Germany, which was the opposite of what the plan had been. Then the Russians are forced to fight this on their own. And they do. And they first resist the sieges at Leningrad. The casualties there were devastating. That went on for 2 winters, 2 years. They lost close to 1 million people in Leningrad. They were reduced to starvation. It was an incredible resistance. And then the Battle of Stalingrad in the winter of 1942, when the Soviets defeat the German war machine. And Hitler says, the gods of war have turned against us. Well, it was true. And the Soviets were therefore on the march. It was because the United States didn't open up the second front earlier that the United States lost the diplomatic initiative and was therefore really on the defensive diplomatically for the rest of the war. The Soviet army sweeps through Eastern Europe and Central Europe, and that's why they got to Berlin about the same time that the Americans did, or shortly thereafter. But what people don't realize is, I did an anonymous survey of college students. These are all A students in high school, right? You think they know some history. And I asked them, how many Americans died in World War II? The median answer I got was 100,000. I mean, 90,000, 90,000. So they were only 300,000 off. Okay, that's at least close to being in the ballpark. I asked them, how many Soviets died in World War II? The median answer I got was 100,000. They were only 27 million off. Can you imagine that high school kids, the college kids now, who are A students in high school, have no understanding at all about World War II? If you don't have some sense that 27 million Russians were killed, you can't understand the Cold War. You can't understand any part of the history of the last 70, 75 years. You can't understand what's happening in Ukraine. These kids are disarmed from the standpoint of being able to do something about it. That 27 million figure is astounding. 27 million people is, remember what happened in the United States after 9/11? How we started 3 wars, we tore up our Constitution, or almost did. 27 million is the equivalent of 1 9/11 per day for 24 years. That's what the Soviets suffered. The Soviets were losing 19,000 people a day. Of the Soviet men who turned 18 in 1941, the first year of the war, 4 out of 5 died. A whole generation was wiped out. So we're dealing with something on a scale that's almost inconceivable. But the fact that there is so much ignorance in this country about that, it's left out of the narratives. If you've seen these commemorations of the end of the war recently, how many of them have talked in any way honestly about what actually won the war? As Churchill says, it was the Soviet army that tore the guts out of the German war machine. The Germans lost 1 million on the Western Front and 6 million on the Eastern Front. But the Americans don't know that narrative, and they don't know very much about the history of the past century.
Well, Peter Kuznick, you're saying that the Russians really won World War II, and they paid a tremendous price for that. And you mentioned the atom bomb. We often think that that's the end of the war in the Pacific. What's the story there?
The story there is that the United States had been conducting strategic bombing of Japanese cities beginning on March 9th and 10th with the firebombing of Tokyo, which General Curtis LeMay considered to be his masterpiece. The Americans had been firebombing cities. We had firebombed actually over 100 Japanese cities The usual number you hear is 64, 66, 67. But Yuki Tanaka has actually discovered that we've firebombed over 100 Japanese cities. The Japanese leaders were accepting that the United States could wipe out cities. In fact, destruction reached 99.5% in the city of Toyama. 99.5%. We could wipe out entire cities. When we had eliminated the big cities that were militarily significant and industrially significant, we started to go after the middle-sized cities that had really no strategic significance or value. We called this terror bombing during the war, because that's what it was. It was state terrorism, and killed hundreds of thousands of Japanese civilians in the process. The atomic bomb, to the Japanese leaders, was not anything new. To them, it didn't make a huge difference whether it was one plane and one bomb or 200 planes and thousands of bombs. They had already accepted that we could wipe out their cities and that we were doing so. What actually ended the war, what changed the equation, was the Soviet invasion. The Soviet invasion begins midnight on August 8th, morning of August 9th. The Americans knew that that's what the Japanese dread the most, because we'd broken the Japanese codes and were intercepting their cables. And they were clear about this, that the thing that they dreaded the most was the possibility of the Soviets entering the war against them, that vast Red Army that had just conquered Europe. The Americans knew that too. If you look at American intelligence, they say the reports to the Joint Chiefs of Staff on April 11th, on July 2nd, for the week of Potsdam and other occasions, it says that very explicitly. Soviet entry into the war will convince all Japanese that further resistance is futile. That was American intelligence. Truman understood that, too. Truman said he went to Potsdam to make sure that the Soviets were coming into the war. And they get the agreement from Stalin the first day at Potsdam. Truman writes in his journal, he says, Stalin will be in the Jap war by August 15th. Finny Japs when that occurs. That's Truman says, Finny Japs when that occurs. He writes to Best the next day and says, the Russians are coming into the war. The war will end a year sooner now. Think of all the boys who won't be killed. Truman knew that. He also knew that the Japanese were trying to surrender. Truman himself refers to the intercepted July 18th telegram as the telegram from the Jap emperor asking for peace. Those are Truman's words. So it was clear that we knew the Japanese understood they were defeated. We knew that they were desperate to find better surrender terms. The problem was they approached the Soviets to try to get the Soviets to help them get better surrender terms from the United States. The Soviets had their own agenda. Soviets were coming into the war. They'd been promised concessions from the United States, similar to what the Japanese were offering them. But the other side of that is that because the Japanese were approaching the Soviets to get better surrender terms, the Soviets knew better than anybody how desperate the Japanese were to surrender. So when former Prime Minister Hirota, Koki Hirota, met with Ambassador Malik in Tokyo, Malik writes back to the Kremlin, the Japanese are desperate to surrender. And that was the attitude in the Kremlin. So when the United States drops the atomic bomb on August 6th and August 9th, the response in the Kremlin is said head spinning in the Kremlin, because the Soviet leaders knew that the real target of the bomb was not the Japanese, who were already defeated and looking to surrender. It was the Soviets themselves. This was the U.S. warning to the Soviet Union that if they mess with America's plans for hegemony in Europe or Asia or around the world, then this is the fate that the Soviets were going to get, and they were going to be the next target of the atomic bomb. This is the beginning of what Garth Apovitz refers to as atomic diplomacy, and the United States is going to use weapons, nuclear weapons, repeatedly. My friend Dan Ellsberg says the United States didn't use nuclear weapons twice. The United States used nuclear weapons repeatedly throughout the Cold War and since, in the same sense that a robber holding a gun to someone's head uses that gun even without pulling the trigger. And that was the policy that the United States established.
We're speaking with Professor Peter Kuznick, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips, and also we have Nolan Higdon here. After this musical break, we're going to return to our conversation with historian Peter Kuznick. Stay with us. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Nolan Higdon. We're speaking with Professor Peter Kuznick from American University. He's co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Peter Kuznick, let's jump into Vietnam, one time the longest war until Afghanistan recently surpassed that. What are your reflections on the ending of the Vietnam War, perhaps the Vietnam War syndrome, as it was referred to by various presidents in the United States? And we'd like to maybe take a walk up through the end of the Cold War and some of your reflections on what's happening now in Eastern Europe. So go ahead, Peter Kuznick.
Well, starting with Vietnam, that's the war of my generation. It's one that I felt very, very deeply. I was very active in the anti-war movement, and to see the ignorance about Vietnam now is also very, very troubling. Much like with World War II, students, younger generation, know very little about Vietnam now. When I ask them why they know so little, they say they usually don't get to it in their history classes in high school. As a result of that, the latest Gallup poll shows that 51% of 18 to 29-year-olds in this country think that the Vietnam War was not a mistake, that the Vietnam War was worth fighting. 51%. That, to me, is mind-boggling. That is just inconceivable after what this country went through, what the Vietnamese people went through, what the world went through with that horrific war. They have no idea, again, of the number of casualties in the Vietnam War. I ask my students, I do my surveys, and they don't come within millions of the actual number. When Robert McNamara, former Secretary of Defense, who's often considered the mastermind behind the war, came to my class, he told my students that he accepts that 3.8 million Vietnamese died in the war. 3.8 million. You almost never see that figure or anything quite close to that. Most Americans think it's 100,000 to a half million when I do my surveys. The memorial to the Vietnam War, the Vietnam Memorial Walls in Washington, D.C., very powerful monument here, that has the names of 58,280 Americans who died. The message is the tragedy of Vietnam is that 58,280 Americans died. That wall is 492 feet long. If it contained the names of all the Americans, all the Vietnamese, all the Cambodians, all the Laotians, everybody who died in that war, it would be over 8 miles long. That, to me, would be a fitting memorial to the Vietnam War and would send a message that the tragedy of that war, the crime of that war, was not that 58,280 Americans died. That was tragic. But that 5 million people died as a result of U.S. policy. And the fact that we don't learn from that, that the younger generation now goes off blind and doesn't know that history, thinks that the war was worth fighting, that it was a just war, instead of understanding this as one of the worst crimes against humanity that has been committed throughout any history, but certainly in the 20th century, and the worst blemish, arguably, aside maybe from the genocide of Native Americans and slavery, against the United States in its history. This is a kind of history that people absolutely need to know, and yet they don't know, and they don't learn this. And when they do learn it, they learn a very distorted nationalist version of it that allows them to think that the tragedy of Vietnam was the 58,280 Americans who died, which was a part of the tragedy of Vietnam. The memorial that I like is the Okinawa War Memorial. I've been to Okinawa the last two summers. In fact, Oliver Stone joined me two summers ago. We went there to support the anti-base movement in Okinawa, and I'm very involved with the anti-base movement there. But the Okinawa War Memorial has the names of all the Americans who died, all the Japanese who died, all the Okinawans who died, all the Brits who died, all the Aussies who died. No matter what country, all those names are on the memorial. That sends a very, very different message, and a very different message about war and about what war means and the real tragedy of war.
Peter, of course, the Vietnam War comes in this Cold War era. And if you look at contemporary media coverage of like Ukraine or the Russian Olympics, there seemed to have been like this Cold War frame when coverage of Russia was happening. Like during the Olympics, they talked about the U.S. being free and how the Russians were spying on people, ironically, while Snowden's exposing that the U.S. spies on its own people. What do you make of that coverage in light of this historical narrative that the Cold War ended?
Oliver Stone and I advance an argument here that says that the Cold War was not really a war against communism. It was at times, but it was really a war of the First World against the Third World. And the fact that those policies did not change after the fall of the Soviet Union, to me, is very revealing, that there's something else driving this military machine. One of the more interesting historical figures I like to talk about is Dwight Eisenhower. When I ask my students what they know of Dwight Eisenhower, they usually talk about his farewell address and his warning against the military-industrial complex, which was a wonderful address and absolutely necessary. And the point that's important to make is that Eisenhower understood the military-industrial complex because he created it. You know, Eisenhower was not the champion of defending against it. Eisenhower was the villain in some ways, as much as one might like Eisenhower on a certain level. If you look at his actual track record, he's largely responsible for having created this. When Eisenhower took office, the United States had little more than 1,000 nuclear weapons. When Eisenhower left office, the United States had almost 23,000 nuclear weapons. When his budgeting cycle was finished, the United States had 30,000 nuclear weapons. I could go into a longer discussion of Eisenhower, but the problem was that the military-industrial complex that was put into effect there has been at the heart of America's war-making and foreign policies ever since. And that did not end when the Soviet Union fell. And the United States is still looking for enemies. The United States is still projecting power around the world. The United States never had the kind of empire that the Europeans had. We don't have colonial empires. We're much smarter than that. We knew that that was a drag, that in many ways that was the wrong way to go. The United States created an empire of bases, an empire of subservient countries around the world. Chalmers Johnson is the one who talked about the United States being an empire of bases, but we still have between 700 and 1,000 bases around the world, in addition to 6,000 bases inside the United States. How many bases do the Chinese have? Our main antagonist in the world today, they've got one overseas base. But the United States, we don't know the exact number.
Peter Kuznick, I want to go and take this historiographically up to the present a little bit, because we have been talking a little bit about students or about what people know in the United States about history. And of course, part of the problem has been, of course, people haven't been exposed to a lot of these subjects in history. And that's what the Untold History of the United States does very well. But just recently, the latest salvo in the war on history and historiography here is in New Jersey. Senator in New Jersey is saying that the AP history standards are insufficiently patriotic. And of course, I'd love to hear your response to that. This has been going on in several other states. We saw the governor of a state in Purdue attack the late Howard Zinn. This is an ongoing affair that somehow we're just not teaching people to be automatonic patriotic shoppers.
Well, I think this country is plenty patriotic enough as it is. God, it's hard to even go to a ball game now without seeing some militarized show.
Well, you know, we know why that is. The Pentagon gave $5.4 million to the NFL to promote military issues during those games. So that wasn't just happenstance.
Yeah, and this has got much worse after 9/11. The militarization of all of American life and culture really got much worse after 9/11. And this kind of patriotism that Peter mentioned before, something about that the project doesn't demonize veterans. In fact, much of what we're saying is just the opposite of demonizing veterans. For example, when we're talking about the atomic bomb not ending World War II, we're saying that the American veterans in the Pacific fought year after year and bravely to defeat the Japanese. And to give the credit instead to the atomic bomb is ludicrous from the standpoint of the veterans and the credit that they did deserve. World War II, if any war is a good war, it's World War II. That the United States was on the side of the angels in World War II. The United States was fighting against Japanese militarism and imperialism and German Nazism and Italian fascism. The United States was absolutely on the good side in World War II. But we're also saying that even in a good war, there is really no such thing as a good war. Whether it was the internment of the Japanese, whether it was the bombing of cities, the slaughtering of civilians, the terrible things that went on during World War II, the whole underside is equally important to understand. And in terms of patriotism, what some people consider patriotism, is the opposite of what I consider patriotism. One of the interesting things about this project is that Oliver and I began from opposite ends of the spectrum. Oliver comes from a conservative Republican family. His father was a top Wall Street broker. And when Oliver went to college in 1964 at Yale, he was a Goldwater Republican. Oliver dropped out of Yale in order to volunteer for combat in Vietnam. Oliver had bought the whole thing. He was a true believer in that sense. And he volunteered for combat in Vietnam, was highly decorated, was wounded twice. People talk about how he saved their lives repeatedly. And you see a lot of that in his movie Platoon, especially, which is based on his own experiences. Born on the 4th of July, which is a great movie, I think is based more on Ron Kovic's experiences. So Oliver's coming from that perspective initially, and I've come from a much more of a left-wing anti-war perspective from the day I was born, really. And I was active in the civil rights movement very, very young age, and in the anti-Vietnam effort, anti-nuclear efforts. But the Oliver and my worldview kind of converged over this period of time. And part of why Oliver wanted to do this project was he wanted to figure out that in late 2007, he said, let's do it. Let's do the documentary. And it was initially going to be a one-hour documentary. Then I went to see him 2 weeks later, the 10-part, 10-hour documentary series. Ended up doing 12 hours, actually, and only 10 of which showed on Showtime. But Oliver wanted to figure out, why hadn't things changed? He wanted to pose the question, was George Bush an aberration? Or was George Bush, who he despised, a continuation of everything that had been going on in U.S. history and politics for the 20th century and even before that? So that was really what we wanted to show, was that in many ways, George Bush was a more extreme version of things that had been set in place for decades and decades and centuries in the United States. So we trace it back to the 1880s and 1890s. And the depression of the 1890s is very important because the United States policymakers decide that the way to get out of the terrible depression of 1893 is to expand overseas. Rather than redistribute wealth at home, rather than have the workers in the United States have a high enough standard of living that they could absorb the American surplus production here at home, the United States decides instead to search for foreign markets, for overseas markets, and to repress workers at home, which was very, very flagrant in the 1880s, 1890s, early 20th century.
Peter Kuznick, we wanted to ask you now, you mentioned that you're going to have a junior high version of your books. You certainly have the 12-hour series already. What's next in terms of your projects and dealing with U.S. history?
A few things, but one is the first screenplay that I wrote for Oliver, which was the first night we met, and I laid out this idea for a movie that he had to make, and Oliver says, Peter, that's a brilliant idea. Let's do it. And then we were having dinner and having a good time, so I didn't think much of it. And then he calls me up the next day from L.A., and he says, he's serious. He says, write me a treatment. And I said, of course, I'd be happy to. Of course, I had no idea what a treatment was. So then I wrote him a treatment, and he said, okay, let me buy this from you, and we'll give over to a screenwriter. I ended up writing the screenplay, which is probably why it didn't get made back then, but why this Untold History project did get made. So I think my next job is to rework that screenplay. It's an incredible story that I think will make a great, great feature film about the early Cold War and the fact that it should have actually been avoided. There's an extraordinary individual who we talk about at length in Untold History, and that's former Vice President Henry Wallace. Henry Wallace has been wiped out of the history books. Vice President from 1941 to 1945. He was a true visionary, a real progressive, who fought against the nuclear arms race, fought against the Cold War, was the most radical person who's ever gotten that close to that level of power in the United States.
Peter Kuznick, we certainly look forward to more from you and Oliver Stone, professor of history at American University, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Peter Kuznick, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to join the Project Censored show.
Thank you. I had a great time.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Nolan Higdon. We've devoted most of today's show to a conversation with Peter Kuznick. He's professor of history at American University and co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. We've been discussing some of the aspects of U.S. history which don't make it into most textbooks. And Peter Kuznick has also been updating us on the progress of his Untold History work. We're going to conclude today's program with audio excerpts from the Untold History series, which we featured before on the Project Censored show. First, we'll hear about Henry Wallace, who Peter mentioned toward the end of our conversation. Wallace was vice president during Franklin Roosevelt's third term, but was dropped from the 1944 ticket by Democratic Party bosses in favor of Harry Truman. Truman then succeeded to the presidency when Roosevelt died in 1945. Wallace remained in the cabinet as Secretary of Commerce, but his outspoken advocacy of peace and coexistence with the USSR irritated the hawks in the Truman administration, prompting Truman to fire Wallace. Here's the segment from the Untold History of the United States.
The only way to defeat communism in the world is to do a better and smoother job of production and distribution. Let's make it a clean race, a determined race, but above all, a peaceful race in the service of humanity. The source of all our mistakes is fear. Russia fears Anglo-Saxon encirclement. We fear communist penetration. Out of fear, great nations have been acting like cornered beasts, thinking only of survival. Common people of the world will not tolerate imperialism, even under enlightened Anglo-Saxon atomic bomb auspices. The destiny of the English-speaking people is to serve the world, not dominate it.
Following Churchill's speech, conditions deteriorated rapidly. When Soviet troops stayed in northern Iran beyond their March deadline, Truman threatened war. He wrote,
"If the Russians were to control Iran's oil, either directly or indirectly, it would be a serious loss for the economy of the Western world."
Truman later privately claimed to a hardline senator that he gave the Soviets a nuclear warning, telling their ambassador, "If Soviet troops are not out in 48 hours, we're going to drop it on you." They were out, he claimed, in 24. The Soviets did withdraw, but probably for reasons other than atomic blackmail. Less than 2 months later, the U.S. cut off desperately needed reparation payments from West Germany to the Soviet Union. And in July of 46, sending another chilling message about its intentions, the U.S. decided to proceed with an atomic bomb test in the Marshall Islands. In September 46, in front of 20,000 people at New York's Madison Square Garden, Henry Wallace tried to put a stop to the growing madness.
If we persist today in a policy of aggression,
the tougher we get, the tougher the Russians will get. We can get cooperation once Russia understands that our primary objective is neither saving the British Empire nor purchasing oil in the Near East with the lives of American soldiers. Under friendly, peaceful competition, the Russian world and the American world will gradually become more alike. The Russians will be forced to grant more and more of the personal freedoms, and we shall become more and more absorbed with the problems of social economic justice.
The speech became world news, deeply embarrassing to Secretary of State Jimmy Burns, who told Truman either he or Wallace had to go. Support for Wallace poured in throughout the ensuing controversy from such as Eleanor Roosevelt and Albert Einstein, but not from the Truman administration. James Forrestal regarded Wallace as at best a security risk and secretly had his Naval Intelligence Unit monitoring the Secretary of Commerce and shared information with the FBI's J. Edgar Hoover, who harbored deep suspicions about Wallace's loyalties. Wallace in turn considered Hoover an American Himmler. Truman later denied he had read and approved the entire speech in advance, which he had. He wrote in his diary,
"Wallace is a pacifist 100%. He wants us to disband our armed forces, give Russia our atomic secrets, and trust a bunch of adventurers in the Kremlin Politburo. I do not understand a dreamer like that.
Truman fired Wallace, and with his departure, the best chance to avert a nuclear arms race was gone. 1947 would be the turning point as the U.S. plunged headlong into the Cold War at home and abroad. Behind the ongoing liberation movements in places such as British Malaya, French Indochina, and Dutch Indonesia, U.S. leadership painted a dire picture of Stalin spreading world revolution, ruling out negotiations and ignoring any grays in its black and white conclusions. In Greece, the British army toppled the popular leftist National Liberation Front and restored the monarchy in right-wing dictatorship, sparking a communist-led uprising. Following the severe winter of 1946-7, the financially strapped British could not control the revolt and asked the United States to take the lead in defeating the Greek insurgents and modernizing the Turkish army. One State Department official later summed it up. Great Britain had within the hour handed the job of world leadership to the United States. A war-weary public had no appetite for costly initiatives, but Truman, addressing both houses of Congress, appealed for $400 million, laying out a new vision for America as the world's policeman.
The very existence of the Greek state is today threatened by the terrorist activities of several thousand armed men led by communists. At the present moment, in world history, nearly every nation must choose between alternative ways of life. I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures.
Truman, in not distinguishing vital threats from peripheral ones, and by linking the fate of people all over the world to the security of the United States, was making a momentous statement. These words could in fact be transposed to Korea, to Vietnam, to Iraq and Afghanistan. After a heated debate, Congress fell into law. Moscow was stunned by this warlike language, accusing the U.S. of imperialist expansion under the guise of charity and trying to extend the Monroe Doctrine to the old world.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Nolan Higdon. Earlier in the program, we spoke with Peter Kuznick, professor of history at American University. He's the co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Now we'll hear another audio excerpt from the Untold History TV series created by Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone. In this excerpt, we learn of U.S. interventions around the world during the administration of Lyndon Johnson. LBJ is best known for escalating the U.S. war in Vietnam, but he also sent American troops into the Dominican Republic. One of his State Department officials, Thomas Mann, made it known that acquiescence to U.S. business interests, not democracy, would be the driver of U.S. policy toward Latin America. That directive became known as the Mann Doctrine. In addition, Johnson supported right-wing coups in Brazil, Greece, and Indonesia. This excerpt from The Untold History begins with a portion of a 1967 speech by Martin Luther King, in which King spoke about some of the U.S. interventions going on at the time.
I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men. I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? If America's soul becomes totally poisoned, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. This need to maintain social stability for our investments accounts for the counter-revolutionary action of American forces in Guatemala. It tells why American helicopters are being used against guerrillas in Cambodia, and why American napalm and green beret forces have already been active against rebels in Peru. They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghetto without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
Two days into office, on the Sunday, the day before John Kennedy was buried, Lyndon Johnson met with his military advisors and said he was not going to lose Vietnam. He'd never agreed with Kennedy's memorandum to withdraw, and 2 days later he issued a new memo signaling the U.S. would be taking a more hands-on approach. His foreign policy thinking was profound in a primitive way.
There are 3 billion people in the world, and we only have 200 million of them. They're outnumbered 15 to 1. Might did make right. We'd sweep over the United States and take what we have. We have what they want.
Who was they? His analogies may have been coarse, but stated in other words, the struggle was not really about communism, but was between the First World and the Third World. Abandoning Kennedy's attempts at reform, Johnson made it clear in the new Mann Doctrine that all Latin American countries would be judged on how they protected the $9 billion in U.S. investments, not on the interests of their own people. The U.S. would no longer discriminate against right-wing dictatorships and regarded military aid as a wiser investment than Kennedy's economic aid. The fifth largest country in the world, resource-rich Brazil, would be the first to suffer. In 1964, new democratically elected president João Goulart implemented land reform and sought controls on foreign capital. Recognizing Cuba was the last nail in his coffin. Castro's example could not be emulated. Johnson sharply reduced U.S. aid. Inflation skyrocketed. The CIA financed large anti-government rallies, and the U.S. administration prodded right-wing officers to overthrow the government. Within a month, the new regime arrested 50,000 people. Torture was instituted. In the next 6 years, $2 billion in U.S. aid flowed into Brazil, and an even more repressive military regime ruled for the next 20 years, worsening an already large gap between rich and poor. The dominoes, in this case the democracies, began falling once again across South America. In 1965, Johnson sent 23,000 troops into the Dominican Republic to crush a popular uprising seeking to restore constitutional order after a military coup. Johnson told his lawyer,
"There ain't no doubt about this being Castro now. They're moving other places in the hemisphere. Be part of a whole communistic pattern tied in with Vietnam."
In Greece, the birthplace of democracy, where the Cold War had taken its baby steps and the U.S. had supported a right-wing government for many years, a new yearning for democracy appeared certain to bring the veteran liberal George Papandreou back as prime minister. Johnson called in the Greek ambassador and actually said,
"Listen to me, Mr. Ambassador. Your parliament and your constitution. America is an elephant. Cyprus is a flea. Greece is a flea. If these two fleas continue itching the elephant, they may just get whacked by the elephant's trunk. Whacked good. You pay a lot of good American dollars to the Greeks, Mr. Ambassador. If your prime minister gives me talk about democracy, he, his parliament, and his constitution may not last very long.
In fact, it didn't. The military junta seized power in 1967, banning miniskirts, long hair, and foreign newspapers, making church attendance compulsory while engaging in numerous incidents of sexually oriented torture and cruelty. Its new prime minister, who had been a captain in a Nazi security battalion, tracking down Greek resistance fighters, became the first CIA agent to become the premier of a European country. But it was Asia that posed the greatest resistance to U.S. goals. Aside from Japan, which was becoming a prosperous client state, Red China exploded its first atomic bomb in October of 64, catching Washington totally off guard. In Indonesia, sitting astride Southeast Asia's principal sea lanes, where more than 3 million members made its Communist Party the third largest in the world behind the Soviets and Chinese, Sukarno, having survived repeated U.S. attempts to remove him, further irritated the U.S. by declaring he would test an atomic bomb. But he was denied help from China. And when he recognized North Vietnam and then expropriated U.S. rubber plantations and threatened to nationalize American oil companies, Lyndon Johnson struck hard. Almost half the officer corps had received some U.S. training. And in October 65, with CIA support, General Suharto led the army in crushing Sukarno's supporters. In the following months, Suharto's militias and civilian mobs went from house to house, killing a half million to a million suspected communists and their families. U.S., British, and Australian intelligence provided thousands of names of suspected communists to the army. Sukarno was forced out finally in 1967 and replaced by General Suharto, who enriched himself, his family, cronies, the Indonesian military, and U.S. corporations for decades until he was overthrown by the people, led by student activists in 1998. In 1968, the CIA acknowledged that the Indonesian massacre ranked as one of the worst mass murders in the 20th century.
I'd like to remind everybody that you are listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. For more information or to listen to archives of previous programs, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Anthony Fest is our producer. Many thanks. Erica Bridgman, our engineer. Many thanks to Erica, too. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Nolan Hingdon. See you next time.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cards that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollars.